story. And halfway through the week, I was thinking, no, I'm going to do something different. But I do believe God's word is inspired and useful for teaching. So, we're going to tackle this. If a film was made of this, it would be 18. We probably wouldn't go and see it, and we'd be picketing outside it. But it's in the Bible. I mean, let's just think about that for a moment. This, if you talked about a story where somebody dressed up and disguised themselves and had sex with their father-in-law, we'd go, what? But it's in the Bible. And what's amazing is she comes out as the heroine in the story. My word. So, in Genesis chapter 37, we looked at the story of Joseph, and it's the beginning part of the story. And it ends at the end of chapter 37 with Joseph being sold by his brothers into slavery, and he's taken to Egypt, and he arrives at an Egyptian nobleman's house called Potiphar. And then at the beginning of chapter 39, so that's 37, at the beginning of Genesis chapter 39, the story picks up as though nothing has happened in the middle, and Joseph is at Potiphar's house. If you ripped out Genesis chapter 38 out of the Bible, the story would make complete sense from the end of chapter 37 into the beginning of chapter 39. So the question emerges, why on earth is it there? Why is it there? So that's the first question. Why is Genesis chapter 38 there? I am not going to look at that one this time, so we're actually going to do two sermons on Genesis chapter 38. So we'll look at that next time, but have a think about it. Why is this chapter here? Because it's here for a reason. The second question that emerges when you start reading through this story is, what on earth does this mean? And how might this help me live my life tomorrow or today? What on earth has this got any relevance to me and to us in our context? So that is the question that I'm going to try and answer today. What does this story mean, and what relevance might it have for us in our life just now? Before we do this, we're going to have a little quiz. If we can stick the quiz up, please. So there is a father, and he has two sons. And he asks the sons to fetch water from a well. The elder son says no. The younger son says yes, but doesn't go. Which son is the better son? So, just have a very quick chat with a partner, someone beside you. Which one is the better son? Okay, if I could bring your attention back now. So, this is not a trap. I'm going to ask you to stick up your hand. I'm only going to give you three options. There could be more, but just for the sake of time, I'm going to give you three options. The first one is that they're both scoundrels. The second one is that the older son is the better son. And the third option is that the younger son is the better son. So I'm going to ask you to stick up your hand. Could I ask you to only stick it up once, but please stick it up once. Put your hand where your mouth is, okay? So who thinks they're both scoundrels? So there's a fair spattering of hands there. Who thinks the older son is the better son, the one who said no? Oh, lots of hands go up there. And who thinks the younger son is the better son? One person. Mike, was there someone else? Oh, okay, two people. So just tell us, why do you think that the younger son is the better person? It doesn't say why he doesn't go. Okay, Danuta, was that you? Any? No, he says he isn't going to go. He is going to go and then doesn't go. So, in my view, when I first heard this, I think they're both scoundrels, but potentially The younger one is even more of a scoundrel because he says he's going to go, and then he doesn't go. And let your yes be yes and all of that. So, in our Western mindsets, we think often that the older son who says no is better than the younger son who says yes, but doesn't go. If we ask this question, and we were in the East somewhere, and we had an Eastern mindset, or the Middle East, they would say the younger son. Do you know why? Because he saves the face and the embarrassment of his father by saying he will do it, even though he doesn't go in the end. Now, if we don't understand this, we're not going to understand the story of Tamar. Because that's the whole premise of the story of Tamar, is about saving face. So, let's get into it. The story. Tamar, when you read the story, comes out, surprisingly, as the heroine, despite the things that happen within the story, by her deceiving her father-in-law and having sex with him. It is really hard for us to understand this story because the cultural context of the story is so different from our cultural context in so many ways. So I'm going to try and explain this, but there's quite a lot to do here. So hang on to your horses. We're going to go at a fair lick. So let's go through the story. Judah leaves his family and his brothers, and the first words that we read in this chapter is verse 1, is at that time. So it's just after Joseph has been sold into slavery. Judah leaves his family and he moves into a town called Adullam, which is a Canaanite city. Now the Canaanites were foreign, they weren't part of the family of God. And in fact, earlier on in the scriptures, we read that marrying a Canaanite was frowned upon. And so he moved to this city in verse 1, and then he marries an unnamed woman. We never get to know who her name is. Judah's wife is never named in the scriptures, but a local woman. Therefore, she was a Canaanite. This was a mixed marriage that was happening here. And she gives birth to three boys, and their names are Onan and Shelah, and we read that in verses 2 to 5. Now, I want us to note between verse 5 and verse 6, there's actually a good number of years. This story goes over probably 20 years, because in verse 6, the boys, who were babies earlier on in the story, have grown up, or at least some of them have. And is married off, probably an arranged marriage, by Judah. And he's married to a girl called Tamar. Now, we're not told this explicitly, but the assumption is that Tamar is also a local lass from the area, and therefore she is a Canaanite, not part of the people or the family of God. So far, so good. Easy enough to understand. But then we read that was evil, and the Lord killed him. Now, there's a sermon in that straight away, but I'm not going to, I know that will raise loads of questions. It does for me, absolutely, but I'm not going to touch on it today because we don't have time. But he dies. And so through no fault of her own, Tamar is now a widow with no children. And this is where the story to our Western modern mindset gets very confusing. Because in verse 8, Judah gives Ur's younger brother, the middle son, Onan, to have sex with her to produce offspring for your brother who has just died. Okay, so we need to understand something about the culture of the day to understand this, and also what happens next. Now, women who had been married previously, please note, I'm just saying something about the culture here. I'm not saying whether it was good or, well, I am saying it was unhelpful in lots of respects. I'm not putting this up as a culture that is good for us. But women who had been married previously and widowed, they had no standing in society. They had no income, they had no place. It was a very risky and scary place to be widowed in that culture. There was no social security, widow's pension, there was no unemployment benefit, there was nothing like that, and this was a matter of life and death for women in that culture if you were widowed without children. So that's number one. Society was very patriarchal, and that basically means that men had all the authority. And in this case, particularly the head of the household or the extended family, Judah, he had all the power in this story, and he basically owned Tamar as a piece of property. So, there was an ancient custom that later got enshrined in Jewish law, and you read about in Deuteronomy, we're going to have a look at those verses, and it was called the Levirate Law. And this was basically when a woman was widowed without having produced any children or an heir, she would then marry the younger brother to produce a son that belonged to her dead husband. Now, when we hear that, I mean, just picture your sister-in-law or your brother-in-law. This is not something that we are even remotely comfortable thinking about. I mean, just the thought is appalling. It's like, no! But that's what happened. Okay. And the purpose of it, well, let's read these verses from Deuteronomy. So this law was in practice, even though it hadn't yet been written down. Deuteronomy came a number of years later and was the writing down of this practice that was commonplace at the time. So Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 5 says, "If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill a duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out of Israel." So, that was the law. Now, at its best, this practice actually really would meant that the woman was provided for. There were perhaps at its best some good things that came from this law. But I do want us to notice that in the Deuteronomy passage, the main purpose of this was to produce a son for your dead husband so that the inheritance would carry on. Produce an heir. It actually, the purpose, the stated intention of it, wasn't about the woman's security and well-being. It was primarily about providing an heir for the dead husband. It may have had a subsidiary effect of giving the woman some kind of security. Okay. Now, this was particularly important if the dead brother was the firstborn or the eldest son. Because in that culture, the firstborn was of prime importance. They would carry the family name, the tradition, and they would inherit a double portion of the inheritance. Now, it's a little bit like some very moneyed, landed gentry families in the UK, where the title and the family estate would be given to the firstborn son, and then all the other children would pretty much have to fend for themselves. It's that kind of feel in the culture. So Lord Joe Bloggs dies, his eldest son inherits the title, so he would become Lord, you know, Phil Bloggs, would inherit the family estate or castle, and then all the other children would get whatever's left over. So that was what happened in those days, and it was to produce continuity for a family. So, with Ur dead, it was now Onan's responsibility to get, just hold on that slide just one moment, Adam. It was now Onan's responsibility to get Tamar pregnant, to produce a son. But the text says Onan knew that the son would not be his. So, firstly, he wasn't that invested in getting Tamar pregnant because the son, or at least the first son, would not be his. But he also had very strong financial reasons for not wanting to get Tamar pregnant. Now, this is the way that inheritance worked. The eldest son would get double portion. So how many children are there? Three. So if he had lived, would have got a double portion of the inheritance. That means he would have got a whopping 50% of the inheritance from Judah. And Onan and Shelah would get 25% each. When dies, Onan's going, yes! For two reasons. Firstly, he's now the eldest son, so he would inherit a double portion. And secondly, there's only two of them. So suddenly, his orange portion from 25% goes up to 66% of the inheritance. Now, if he gets Tamar pregnant, the son is not his, but Ur's, his dead elder brother, who would inherit now the double portion that his dad would have inherited if he was alive. So Onan, if he gets this last pregnant, his proportion goes down from 66% back down to 25%, because Ur's son, that Onan had fathered, would have picked up 50% again. Very strong financial reasons not to do it. So the text says that Onan spilled his seed or his semen on the ground. It's a very primitive form of contraception, of withdrawing your penis before ejaculation. And what he did was evil. And so he dies too, verse 10. So, at this point, according to that Levirate custom, the next youngest son, the only remaining son, Shelah, should have been given to Tamar to produce offspring for Ur, who had died previously, tragically. But Judah seems to blame Tamar for the death of his two sons. He seems to hold her responsible, and he doesn't want his one remaining son to die too. So in his mind, he's saying, I am not going to fulfill the obligation of giving my youngest son to this lass, because there's obviously something really dodgy about her. And I don't want my third son to die. What he says is that Shelah, my third son, is not old enough to marry just yet. So you go and live with your father as a widow, pledged to this younger son, and I will give him to you when he comes of age. Are you with me so far? So, verse 12, after a long time, literally after a number of days, but presumably a year or two. And it seems at this point that Shelah, the youngest son, is now of an age where he could get married. But it dawns on Tamar that she is not going to be given to him. That was not Judah's intention. And this leaves Tamar in a very difficult position. She is pledged to this man, this boy that's become a man. She is not free to marry anyone else. Judah, as the head of the family, who owns, in a sense, the property, his word is final, is not letting Shelah take Tamar. So she's trapped. She can't get out of it, and she can't move forward. She's legally bound to him. And it also means that she is unable to carry on the name of her dead husband, which was part of her obligation in those days. Hence, when you read a number of women who are unable to have children and the shame that there is attached to that in biblical times. In verse 12, we're also told that there is another really significant thing that happens here. Judah's wife dies. Why is that significant? Well, we need to understand two further things about the culture of the day. So this law around Levirate marriage, where you were given to a brother, could also be extended to other family members. It's not just to the brothers of the dead man. It could even include father-in-law. That was part, I know this is so alien to us, isn't it? I mean, can you, you know, we just can't imagine any circumstances where it's okay to sleep with the father-in-law, but this was part of the custom of the day, that if there weren't any brothers that could stand in the place of the dead man that had died, then it could be other family members, including father-in-law. So the fact that Judah's wife has now died makes him available to fulfill the obligation of producing an heir for Ur, who died right at the beginning of the story. Okay? First fact. Second fact is that they live in an honor-shame culture. Now, apparently, I'm not an expert here, so if you're an anthropologist, please excuse my very basic understanding of this, but apparently there are three types of cultures. There's a fear-based culture. There's a guilt-based culture, which predominantly we are. Probably all cultures have a little bit of element of each, but we're predominantly a guilt-based culture. And then there are shame-based cultures. This is a shame-based culture. So when we read this text, we read about right and wrong. And we start evaluating the actions of the different characters in this text through right and wrong. That's what we did with the two sons who wouldn't go and draw water. We evaluate whether they're right or wrong. Somebody else from a different culture won't evaluate whether it's right or wrong. They'll evaluate about the shame that comes on different people because of actions. You have to read the story through shame-based eyes to understand it. Have to. So, Tamar would have lived under shame for not having borne children and not having produced offspring for her husband Ur. So, the death of Judah's wife opens up the possibility for Tamar that her shame could be removed, that she could bear a child, that she could continue the family line for her dead husband. If her brother-in-law, the youngest son, Shelah, was being withheld by Judah, then maybe Judah could do the honors. Except that Judah wasn't likely to readily agree to that. He thought Tamar was the reason that his two sons had died already. So Tamar devises a plan. Hearing that Judah is going to be passing on by on his way to a sheep shearing kind of festival, it's like going to some kind of festival, she takes off her widow's clothes, clothes that she was wearing that would mark her out as a widow and therefore unavailable. She takes off those widow's clothes and she disguises herself with a veil and she sits on the road that Judah will walk past on his way to the sheep shearing festival. Judah passes by, but he doesn't recognize her. This is verse 15 to 17, if you're following in the scriptures. Judah doesn't recognize her, and he thinks that she is a prostitute. And they start negotiating over the price. They settle eventually on a young goat. But the thing is, with Judah, this was obviously an opportunistic thing. And he hadn't brought his wallet. He hadn't got the young goat that he was going to give this young girl as a price for having sex with her. So she says, well, can I have a guarantee, a pledge? And Judah says, well, what kind of pledge do you want? And Tamar says, the pledge that I want is a seal with its cord and your staff. Now, in essence, that would be like asking for a passport. It was as easily identifiable who those belong to as this passport identifies me. It's essentially saying, here, take my passport as a guarantee that I will give you the money that... Yeah, the photograph's not great. I hope it's me because I need it for a plane in couple of days' time. So this pledge would have identified Judah. Now, they sleep together when this arrangement is done. The text says that Tamar became pregnant. She then disappears back home. She takes off the veil. She puts on her widow's clothes again. And the next day, Judah's mate goes along with the goat, trying to get back the passport, the pledge, the guarantee, and give the goat as the payment for having sex. But she's not there. He asks around, and nobody knows of any prostitute that has been working that patch of land. Judah shrugs off this episode in verse 22 and 23, not wanting to cause himself any embarrassment. Then we need to fast forward 3 months on. 3 months later, people notice that Tamar's not quite as slim as she used to be, that she has a bulging belly and has become pregnant. And she's therefore guilty of having sex with somebody else other than Shelah, the youngest son who she's been pledged to. And this was a crime punishable by death in that culture. Judah wants her burnt alive in verse 24. Now, remember, Tamar still got the passport. She could have just waved and said to everybody, "This is the man that got me pregnant. Look at the photo." But she doesn't. She sends a private message to Judah. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," and gives back the seal and the staff. Judah recognizes them instantly, realizes what has happened, and then declares, "She is more righteous than I," is how the translation translates it. But literally, "She is righteous, not I." She is righteous, not I. Wow. So Tamar has broken out of the trap that she was in. She's produced... I'll take my passport back just so that I don't forget it. Thank you. Tamar's broken out of the trap that she was in. She's produced offspring for her dead husband, fulfilling her duty in that culture. To a very significant extent, in that culture, she has removed the shame that was on her and the shame of her dead husband, But it is worth noting how she's done this. She did this by sparing the shame of Judah. She did this by sparing Judah's embarrassment. She didn't publicly shame him. She didn't get out the passport, as it were, the staff and the seal, and shout from the rooftops, "It's this man that's got me pregnant." She did it through a private message. Now, I wanted to take this one stage further. The verses that we read in Deuteronomy about the Levirate marriage continue in verse 7 of chapter 25. However, this is dynamite stuff, okay? God, they should make a film of this, because this is incredible. So listen to this. "However," so it's just said, if a brother dies, then one of the other brothers need to man up, get with this woman, produce offspring for your dead brother's lineage. "However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders of the town gate and say..." So the elders of the town gate was like going to the local courtrooms, public courtrooms. "My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel." So he's refusing to marry her. "He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me. Then the elders of the town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, 'I do not want to marry her,' her brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of elders." Notice it's public. in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, this is what is done to the man who will not build up my brother's family line. This man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled. I mean, what an insult. But both, all of those actions, the phrasing, the insult, the sandal, the spitting, is all to produce shame on the man who's not going to marry her. It's all about shame. So Tamar, number one, could have got the passport out and just said, I was made pregnant by this man. Number two, she could have gone to the gates of the city, to the local courtroom, as it were, and say, I am legally bound, honor-bound. Judah is honor-bound to give me Shelah. And if he doesn't, I'm going to take his sandal, I'm going to spit in his face, and call him family of the unsandaled. She doesn't do either of those. She saves his face. There's so many ways in which I think this story, or a number of ways in which this story could be really fascinating. I mean, as I was preparing it, I was thinking of Chris and Anne. The work... let me explain quickly. Oh, man. Perhaps we'll just move on from there. Just leave that as a thought. I was thinking about Chris and Anne, but another thought is... I was thinking about the work that they're doing to not make the selling of sex illegal, but the buying of sex. This story speaks into that. It speaks into women being trapped in poverty, in situations that they didn't deserve. Chris could tell you the statistics of the number of people that work the streets in the UK, and most of them are not there by choice. Isn't that right? You could tell me the numbers, probably. Virtually none are there by choice. And yet so often we blame them and not the men. This story speaks to that brilliantly. Absolutely amazingly. But I want to just focus and finish on thinking about honor and shame. At the end of the story of Ruth, which has remarkable parallels to this story, we read about a genealogy, about the naming of a number of different generations to the birth of the greatest king that Israel had, King David. And in that genealogy, Tamar, a foreign woman, not part of the family of God, who slept with her father-in-law, is named in that genealogy. In Matthew's gospel, in the description of the lineage to our amazing Jesus, Tamar is mentioned. She is honored in the people of God. We don't understand it because we read the scriptures through the eyes of right and wrong and guilt. We don't read it through the eyes of shame and honor. And she is honored because she did not dishonor Judah. Wow. Judah deserved dishonoring. He behaved despicably. We'll look at that next time. Tamar is honored. It's amazing. She could have died. The path she took was the risky path. It would have been much simpler to bring out the passport. It would have been much simpler to go to the law courts and spit and take the sandals and call that family the family of the unsandaled. She could have been stoned to death or burned to death for her actions, but she did it because she was not going to dishonor Judah. There is a Jewish saying that springs from this story. If you shame your neighbor, you shame God himself. For it is written, in the image of God, he made man. Wow. You shame your neighbor, you shame God. Because everyone is made in the image of God. Into the New Testament, we are invited to honor people. We're invited to honor our parents. There's no end to that. Even when you reach Colin's age. Sorry, Colin. You're invited to honor leaders. And then this is the verse that I particularly love. We are invited to honor those that are dishonorable. The least honorable amongst us, we are encouraged to honor. In 1 Corinthians 12, the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. Now, I don't think there are many things in the Christian life that we are encouraged to be competing with one another about. But did you know that the New Testament instructs us to compete with one another about honoring people? That we can go, I honor people more than you. We're encouraged to compete about honoring. In Romans 12, it says, outdo one another in showing honor. Outdo one another in showing honor. Some translations will translate that slightly differently, but I love that translation. Outdo one another in showing honor. Danny Silk from Bethel Church in California says, honor is to treat people according to the way that God says they are. It's to treat people according to the way that God says they are, not what others say, not what they might say themselves about themselves, and certainly not about the way that they behave. It's about what God says about them. So there's some things wrapping up about honor that I just want to say. Firstly, it's about what do we see? When we look at someone, what do we see? It recognizes what God says about the person, not what they say or other people say or what we might think. It's about what God says about the other person, that we are all made in the image of God. We all have dignity. Sometimes, if I'm honest, that's really hard to see. But everyone has dignity and worth and value. They're beautiful, amazing, incredible, fantastic human beings. That's the thing that God sees. That's what God says about each one of us here today. We're amazing and fantastic, incredible, awesome human beings that have been created for a purpose. There's no one else that's like you in this world to do the things that only you can do. That's amazing. So what do you see? Do we see the faults? Do we see the issues? Do we see the things that they get wrong? Or do we see the amazing, incredible value and worth and dignity of every single human being? What do you see? Secondly, how do we behave towards the other person? I love what Tamar does. She doesn't call wrong right. She doesn't say it doesn't matter. But she doesn't uncover Judah. She doesn't expose his wrongdoing and his sin in a public way. She behaves to him as though he has dignity and value, and she even honors the place that he has in the family as head of the household. Wow. So in this house, that's how we behave with people. In this house, we treat people with respect and dignity. Regardless of what they've done, we don't expose wrongdoings. We don't call wrong right, but we treat people with dignity and respect, and we help people to try to reconnect with who they are, with who God says they are. Even when we mess up, we help people clean up the mess and become who they are meant to be. That's how we treat people in this house. Thirdly, what do we say? We speak words of life to people. We help them to see the amazing dignity and worth and value that they have as a human being. I want us to note that Tamar never said to Judah, "You woeful, awful, rotten worm of a sinner." It was her kindness that led him to repentance. And we will look at that next time. We're going to take bread and wine. And it's at the cross. Chris, I wonder if you could come back. In a minute, I'm going to ask the parents to go and get their children because we'd love the kids to participate in this. So you need to go and collect your children. They can't come down if they're in the younger two age groups. But in a minute, we're going to come and take bread and wine. And it's in the cross that Jesus bears our shame. We have incredible dignity and value and worth. And there are bound to be some people here that you don't believe that about yourself. You don't believe that you are amazing and wonderful, incredible, created with beauty and purpose. And as we come and we take this bread and wine, we can receive, we can exchange our shame to reconnect with the dignity that is inherently ours. And as we come and take bread and wine, maybe what you see in others is not their beauty and their dignity and their value and their amazingness, but what you see is how they have behaved and how they are wrong and how they do things bad. And today, the only way that I can say that can change the way we do that is by prayer and coming to Jesus. That we start asking him to see people the way that he sees them. And so if you feel you have an attitude of judgment, of wrong, of criticism, then I want to ask that as you come here, come and confess that's the way you see people and implore and ask the Holy Spirit to change your heart that you could see people the way that Jesus sees them.